Hello and welcome to the Leaders in Supply Chain and Logistics podcast. I'm your host, Rado Palamariu, Managing Director of Elcot Global. Our mission is to connect the supply chain ecosystem in Asia and globally by bringing forward the most interesting leaders in the industry. And it's my pleasure to have with us today Adi Vaidya, who's the Chief Operating Officer at Zilingo. Zilingo is the top fashion and lifestyle marketplace allowing smaller merchants from Southeast Asia without an online presence to list their items for sale direct to consumer. They have raised Series D funding of $226 million, nearing almost a $1 billion valuation. Adi founded the Indonesia business and grew it from zero to one of the largest fashion marketplaces in ASEAN today. And he also set up the B2B platform and designed the entire logistics flow from seven countries into ASEAN, primarily Indonesia, to support the procurement needs of sellers. He soon also took over the entire supply chain optimization and set up hubs in Bangladesh, Vietnam, Korea, China, Thailand, Myanmar, and so on. He is the Chief Operating Officer since 2017 at Zilingo, and he now drives the company's P&L of almost $1 billion, and operational efficiency across business units, including B2B and B2C. He also looks after more than 300 people in six geographies, and he's rapidly expanding his team, so do look him up after this podcast in case you're interested to apply. Adi, pleasure to have you with us today, and thank you for your time.
Thank you, Rado, pleasure.
Super. So maybe start by telling us a little bit about your background, because I know you didn't, you know, do all your yeah. life e-commerce, right? So you came from actually Citibank and then you ended up at Zilingo. So tell us a little bit about yourself personally and how you ended up.
Sure. Would love to. So I'm actually from a small town in northern part of India. Grew up there without much access to information and without much exposure to the online world itself. When I first moved to Mumbai, that was for a university. That is when I, let's put it this way, saw the world for the first time in a way. And I was already 18 at that point of time, 17 or 18 at that point of time. And it was eye-opening in many ways. People, businesses, processes, etc. All of those things were sort of coming in front for the first time in life, and it was all very, very fascinating. I did a degree in management studies from St. Xavier's College in Mumbai, and that's where I actually met Ankiti, who was a 1 year senior to me in college, and both of us worked together on multiple college festivals, so sort of developed a working bond from there itself. She moved on and started working in management consulting and VC later, and I moved on and started working with banking. And of course, it was literally like one of those moments where you are a 20-something and you get a prestigious job and you're like, hey, this is probably what I'm destined for. And that's how I landed up in Citibank, and I started working with some tech and pharma clients, actually. So I did 2 years in Citibank. I was based in the Mumbai headquarters, and I think over time started meeting a lot of our clients. So I used to deal with a lot of local Indian corporates, and I started working with a lot of, as I said, starting with pharma and tech companies, and then later also into some of the companies that were doing financial services, so non-banking financial institutions. I think the core learning that came out of that entire experience was, and of course, at this stage, I wasn't really sure what I really want to do in life, but the core learning that sort of started coming up, especially in the Indian ecosystem of corporates, was that things are really marred by inefficiencies. Now, when we are working with NBFCs who are lending to, one of the NBFCs I was working with was actually lending to truck drivers. And that's where the first sort of interaction with smaller businesses happened. And you could see that those people are not really at advantage. If something could be done for them, it would definitely change lives of many people involved. Unfortunately, when you're working with a bigger financial institution, you're actually working in the interest of the bigger corporates, etc. And maybe, and nothing wrong in that, but and that's the client set those guys are working on. But that is somewhere where I guess the first sort of hints came that, hey, I really want to help the other side of the spectrum, where you could actually work with these smaller businesses and maybe have impact on scale. And I think two and a half years of Citibank, and one fine day Ankiti called me and she said that, hey, I'm looking at this idea of doing something for businesses in the fashion and lifestyle supply chain. Wasn't very aware of how the entire supply chain works. So did a bit of a study, met her a few times, and we started coming down to Bangkok a couple of times as well. So Bangkok, India, a couple of other countries were some of the first sort of places where we were doing the hypothesis or running the hypothesis on. And that's when sort of we decided that, hey, this really is an untapped opportunity. I think where the idea also came from was we were coming from India, where the Flipkart and the Amazon revolution was really on the up. Southeast Asia, on the other hand, even though after so many trips that we made, we realized that even though it has much better infrastructure, both in terms of logistics as well as in terms of smartphone penetration, internet penetration, etc., was somewhere lagging behind as compared to, let's say, an India or a China in terms of this entire e-commerce revolution. So I think that is where we sort of found a natural fit, and we knew that if we don't do it now, someone else is definitely going to do it. There were, of course, the Rocket Internet companies at that point in time, and all the credit to them for sort of clearing the jungle. But they were either extremely horizontal marketplaces like the likes of Lazada, or they were people who were working on slightly higher end brands. No one was really aggregating the smaller businesses, which is what we wanted to do. And that's how we ended up in Bangkok and started the business from there.
Mm-hmm. Super. I mean, so, you know, it's important to who you go to college with, right?
Yeah.
choose your good, good crowd around you. Yeah?
Totally.
And tell us a little bit, because, you know, there's listeners from all over the world that will tune into the podcast. Tell us a little bit about Zilingo and explain it very simply to them in case they're not familiar with it.
Surely. When we started the business, and from the last question itself, the idea was to aggregate small fashion merchants in ASEAN, bring them to light in terms of the digital economy, and give them a platform to sell to consumers across the region. That is simply where we started from. It was as simple as that, aggregating small businesses and giving them a place to sell. I think over the last 4 years, the idea or the business has evolved quite drastically. What started happening after about a year, year and a half of us doing this, what we realized is that the biggest challenge is not really selling here. The biggest challenge for these guys is not really selling. Of course, it's great to have a platform that empowers them or enables them to sell to businesses across the region or maybe consumers across the region. But the challenges are far deeper entrenched than just a distribution challenge. The bigger challenge, for example, for these smaller businesses was sourcing. Like, hey, where do I really source from? Or another bigger challenge was financial services. The banks or institutions in this part of the world were not willing to touch these businesses, these small businesses. Or another bigger challenge was that, hey, I have this agent who I can procure from, but what do I really procure? I don't know what to procure. So when we started sort of looking into these challenges and sort of went a bit more upstream, we realized that the B2B side of things, where the businesses are dealing with other businesses, is not really solved for to a great extent. And of course, B2C is a lot more sexy and people want to solve for it. B2B is getting your hands a lot more dirtier. But when we did that, the output per unit effort was a lot higher. And that's when we realized that, hey, maybe this is also something that we should start exploring. And today, I think 4 years later, B2B is actually a larger part of the business at this point in time, where we do multiple services on helping these businesses and stakeholders, literally from sourcing to financial services to trend analytics, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where the business has evolved to today, from just being a small e-commerce marketplace.
Mm. So you would say that right now you are more into the B2B space than you are into the B2C, because you have both elements.
We
right?
do have both. Definitely. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that we move from B2C to B2B in any way. What happened actually was B2C, of course, kept growing at its steady pace. And in Indonesia, for example, we are still the largest fashion marketplace. But the growth in B2B was so high or so fast that as a proportion now, the B2C business seems a bit smaller. So it's just that the growth on the one side of business was a lot higher.
Yes, got it. Somebody was asking the question in terms of, I think you mentioned at some point that you envision Zilingo as a revolutionary new retail platform that acts as a single one-stop solution for merchants and manufacturers. How would you describe it? So let's just go into the practicality of it.
Yeah.
You know, how do you envisage that, and how would that help people?
Yeah, sure. So taking a step back, right, like how really does the fashion supply chain work at this point in time? And what do we mean really when we say that it's broken, right? So if you're a business who's trying to procure, let's say, in the US, and you want to procure from a manufacturer in Asia, let's say in Indonesia, it is extremely hard to get that connection right and get this entire flow done in an efficient manner. Now, what does that mean? Or how would you end up doing it? Now, let's say I'm a business somewhere in the US. I will reach out to an agent in my state first, who reaches out to an agent, let's say, in New York, who reaches out to a customs agent in, let's say, somewhere in China, who's then working with some other agents, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the whole process is marred by middlemen. There are middlemen after middlemen after middlemen, each of those sucking in 5 to 10% of the margins, making it extremely expensive for the final brand to eventually procure those items, or making it extremely hard at the first place to even understand what to procure. So one of the things that we talk about a lot internally is called yarn to closet. So what we are saying, or what we are envisioning, or what we are telling our teams internally, is that our objective is to make the yarn to closet process as simple as possible. We want to remove these middlemen and ensure only the right people, or the people who add value, stay in this supply chain. So we work today, for example, with people from who are producing yarn to fabrics, to ready-made garments, to brands, and eventually consumers. And those are really the people who are adding value. Other than that, it's just some sort of information arbitrage that is happening, and you're making money on that. So the idea is to remove that information arbitrage with the help of technology, enable these businesses, whether they're in the US or LATAM or in Asia itself, to see or to directly connect with these bigger manufacturers or suppliers or businesses. And the tool allows them to do that because it is highly localized, both in terms of currency and language, and then to let them procure and choose what they want to procure and choose. And of course, we enable them or we help them to do it better through multiple things, including a trend analysis tool or a financial services tool, as I told you.
And let's go a little bit in terms of the, because there's, as you said, there's the underneath this, so the vision is clear, yeah. But underneath it is, you have a lot of, on the operation side, yes. And you're in charge of supply chain optimization. You set up hubs in all those, yes, countries. Tell us a little bit, what does that mean? I mean, how do you make it happen? How do you measure it? How do you tangibly look at it?
Sure. So, and I'm glad you mentioned the point about supply hubs as well, right? So the thing is, all of this, and one of the realizations that we've had over the last 4 years, is that all of this can't work simply by having an app or a tool and then just praying and hoping that this will work out. You need to have people on the ground, and you need to have these hubs created where technology is actually empowering these hubs. But technology, in my view personally, is an empowerer. It is not going to replace the human touch. It is not going to replace these physical hubs that we're trying to create. So one of the hubs that we have created is in Tirupur, in southern part of India. Another hub that we've created is in Bandung, in outskirts of Jakarta in Indonesia. What happens there is that we have an office or a team of people on the ground who are actually going and meeting these manufacturers pretty much on a weekly or a monthly basis. What they do there is that they go and understand what is the biggest problem that these guys are facing. Now, to give you an example and to make it a little more tangible, right? So one of the factories that we were working with in Indonesia told us that, hey, our biggest challenge is that I have 10 lines, if you understand the concept of lines in manufacturing of clothing. So they said, hey, I have 10 lines here, and somehow I'm not able to figure, but my production capability is going down, and I'm just not able to figure what's happening. Now I have these 10 lines, and I'm not really sure what is going wrong where. So we worked and we helped establish an ERP mechanism, quality control mechanism, for them there, using the technology that we have, plus the partners that we work with. And they were then able to figure which of these lines were actually doing better and which of the lines were not doing better, and why those lines were not doing better. So this technology, or this tech, basically enables them to see that on a, let's say, a heat map basis, this particular line has 5 defaults, or this particular line has only 1 default. And then you can actually figure that out, take it out and solve that problem, and then fix it. So those are some of the things that we've started doing. And again, on a very, very tangible level, this was a very, very microscopic example where literally to the level of line efficiency is something that we're trying to solve for. And then, of course, there are metrics attached to these things on which factory is doing better in terms of let's say lesser defects, better sort of delivery timelines, etc. So that is sort of on a very ground level how this is working.
No, but that's fascinating, and I mean, I didn't realize that you go into that much
yeah.
detail. And then I mean, I'll sidetrack a little bit with the question now. But so, how do you charge on? I mean, in terms of the business model,
yes.
right? So, okay, because if you know somebody posts an item for sale on your website,
yes.
and then you sell, then
yes.
you get a cut. It's quite
yes.
straightforward, right?
Yes.
But in this case, I mean, how
yes.
do you charge? Is it like a subscription? I mean, how do you?
For sure. So, I think the model is still the same. The model is very clear to us in our head, where we don't want to charge the business partners that we work with unless they sell. The idea is to make sure that as you sell or when you sell, we charge you for it. Now, these tools on the whole, and we don't enforce businesses to necessarily pay a lot of money for these tools. Of course, there might be a minimal subscription fee because if something is for free, people don't value it. But other than that, the whole idea or the concept for the business as a philosophy has been the fact that tech tools, all of those things are going to be more like growth hacks. These are the things that are actually going to get you these people in to start working with you. Because you know what will happen? And this is something that we've tested before. If you go out and you tell someone that, hey, I'm going to establish these tools or I'm going to put these tools in your factory, it's extremely hard to get a buy-in if you start charging for it from day one. Till the time the person doesn't see some sort of output coming out of that, mm-hmm. they won't. We've actually converted factories where we started working with these tools for free, let's say, and 6 months down the line, they were like, hey, this is extremely useful. And we were like, hey, we want to charge something for this. And they're totally comfortable doing that. So we need to first show them an impact. Again, we don't want to be here as someone who comes and says that, hey, no, buy this, mm-hmm. this, and I'm going to charge money for this. We want to show impact first. The two philosophies that we work on for our businesses and for ourselves is improvement in top line and improvement in bottom line. Improvement in top line is a lot easier method to get an in. Improvement in bottom line is a more longer term play. And we feel like both are extremely critical, but you need to go from the top line approach first, install the things that will help improve bottom line, and then over time start monetizing on that.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of okay, so if we had to look at some of the current challenges that you face,
sure.
right? So all this is really interesting, and I'm sure that you know that's why they have you, right? You know, operations people
yeah.
are there to fix problems.
Yeah.
So what's some of the biggest problems that you face in your operations at the moment?
I think in terms of the ecosystem on the whole, it's and from the first question I was mentioning that we're very grateful to the likes of Rocket Internet who cleared the jungle. As we started going upstream, the jungle is still there. Like it's not yet been cleared. It's extremely hard. So a lot of people ask us that, hey, who's your competition or who are you like? It's very hard to explain. So when there is no comparison, it becomes hard for not just the people you work with, for the investors, for the media, to really understand what you're trying to do. For example, if Uber is burning, or if an Uber was burning millions of dollars, and Lyft comes in and says that, hey, you know what, I'm also going to burn maybe $10 million lesser, but there is a comparison here. So when we come in and we try to tell a business that, hey, you know what, why don't you work with us and do that? And they're like, hey, but who are you? Like, what are you guys? So I think education is a big, big challenge. The upstream side of things, or the B2B side of things, is still undereducated, I would say, in this entire scheme of things. And the second bit is that the entire ecosystem, as I spoke, is still very geared for a B2C side of things, especially here. China is not, which is great because Alibaba cleared that jungle there. But Southeast Asia, ASEAN, which we feel has a tremendous potential with the entire US China trade battles, etc., happening, is still undereducated. So I think in terms of both education and the ecosystem development, where as an example, if I were to be a little more specific, you will find 20 logistics partners to work with you on B2C. On B2B, probably the number is 2. Because people have not even thought about those challenges or those issues that, hey, if you were to ship something from as simple as an Indonesia to a Philippines, what would really happen? What are the custom duties that are going to be actually involved in? And are you going to do sea freight? Are you going to do air freight? How are you going to work around those things? So in B2C, solutions are very bespoke. In B2B, it's still a lot harder.
Hmm. I mean, and also, I mean, let's face it. I mean, with hard problems yes. come also potentially very good business opportunities. So
totally.
Easy problems.
Totally. And I guess that has been the reason, as I mentioned, that the output per unit effort that we're seeing on B2B is just extremely high. It's like, if someone is actually coming in and trying to explain that, hey, this is what we're trying to create, people really do get it, especially the businesses who work with clients globally. They do definitely get it.
Mm. Another question that comes to my head, top of my head, you know, in the flow of the moment. Yes. Like, so how do you, let's say I'm a client, right?
Yeah.
Back to your, no, you don't really, I mean, there's not so much. I mean, basically, you're quite unique in what you do.
Yeah.
So when they ask you, so you're like who? You're like what?
Yeah.
What are you? You know,
yeah.
What's the simplest way that you
yeah.
explain?
I think good question. And we've been thinking about it for quite some time as well. We used to go with multiple approaches. So to someone, you will say that, hey, I can help you procure better. Or to someone else, you will say that, hey, you know what? I am also the biggest B2C marketplace in Indonesia, or maybe doing well in Thailand, in Philippines. I can help you sell better. Or you can go with the approach that, hey, you know what? It's very hard for you to get access to banks, etc. But we partner with UOB, with multiple other financial institutions, DBS. We can help you get financial services better. But it's just a complicated pitch every time, because you're trying to tailor it for the client. So that approach, of course, still works. But one of the good things that happened that our tech guys who work out of Bangalore in India did was that we created a single UI or single UX experience for our businesses. And it's a recent development, not a very complicated piece of tech, but one of the landmark things that we did, actually, where now there is a single app which we go and show the business and we say, you know what, this is us. So it says source, it says sell, it says financial services, it says ERP, HRMS, whatever you want in one piece. So we say that, hey, we are a single stop solution for you as a business to do whatever. And we were talking about this internally. There are a couple of people in the team who had their own businesses, and they were like, hey, if I had something like this, it would have made life so much easier, because I can just go and say, I want to procure this, I want access to financing, I want to also sell here. It's all there in one place. So a single stop solution now. Of course, when we go and meet multi-million dollar clients, it's a lot different there. We try and pitch in a more tailor-made fashion. But for smaller businesses, it's the single stop solution.
No, super. And you know, the fact that you've got people within, and you know, there's a couple of obviously entrepreneurs, there's a lot of entrepreneurs within the company, as I know. And if they said that, let's put it this way, scratching your own itch is a very good strategy.
Totally.
for making it.
And I think what helps a lot is, totally aligned, what helps a lot is that we are talking to our manufacturers like all the time, and we are talking to our sellers all the time. And of course, B2B is comparatively newer, but B2C sellers are B2B buyers. So you keep meeting them, asking them that, hey, what is it that is going to really help you?
Yes, yes. One listener had the question in terms of going a little bit into your main consumer portfolio and then
yeah.
target markets for expansion.
Yeah.
If you can give us some idea on that.
I think it would have been a lot simpler answer about a year ago. It's a lot more complicated today. What we've started realizing as we started going upstream was that, hey, it's not just the ready-made garment manufacturer who needs help. It's not just the brand who needs help. You know what? The fabric guy also really needs help. Or you know what? The yarn guy also really needs help. So the target consumer is pretty much every stakeholder in the fashion and lifestyle supply chain, starting from yarn to fabric to RMG to brand and consumer. And we are tailor-making solutions for all of them. Of course, for a consumer, the solution is far different from all the other businesses in the supply chain, but you tailor make. So for fabric, for example, it's a lot easier for you to sell online as compared to a ready-made good, because fabric specifications are a lot more standard. The problem though, what the fabric guys face, is that there are very few people making fabric as compared to, let's say, a ready-made garment manufacturer. So it's I wouldn't say the problem they face, but the problems that arise from the fabric to ready-made garment section is very different. So there are actually a cartel of middlemen between the fabric guy and the manufacturer, which is skewing the prices so bad. This is something that we realized in Indonesia, that if you are able to remove that cartel from there, the prices of fabric, which is actually 60% of the ready-made garment's price, falls, and the efficiency that you can bring in by just doing that is immense.
Mm. Tell us a little bit, maybe you have an example of you know, one specific, I'm sure there's many, yeah. but there's one specific case study, maybe the more impressive one, right? In terms of some actions that you took or some changes or tweaks in the system yeah. that really created yeah. an impact.
Yeah. I can actually talk about a couple of them. Sure. Maybe one on the B2B side, one on the B2C side. So on the B2B side, this particular example, right? So we were working with manufacturers in Bogor and Bandung. There are only two major hubs for fabric in Asia, pretty much globally as well. So India is really, really good for cotton, and China is really, really good for poly. And then you have Taiwan, Korea, etc., doing more specific sort of fabrics, more high-end fabrics. But India and China broadly are doing a lot more fabric into our part of manufacturing. Now, Indonesia fabric is a sunset industry. So very, very few people are really manufacturing fabric in Indonesia. So these manufacturers, when you're talking to them, they said that, hey, you know what? The biggest pain point is fabric procurement, because I have to either fly down to China every 3 months, every 6 months, and find out what's happening there. I don't understand the language. I don't know what currency they are using. Or I have to talk to these agents who are here in my city or in my town, and they will do it for me. Now, when we dug deeper, we realized that these agents actually are nothing but an individual businessman who's actually going to China. What he does is he gets the swatches of fabric into Indonesia, marks up it by like 100%, and then shows it to these guys. Again, they don't have any options, so they're just buying it. So the project that we started there was that, hey, let's eliminate these middlemen. What we do is we have a small team in China and Hong Kong as well, that we'll aggregate these fabric manufacturers and get them on board onto our platform and directly present these as a solution to our clients. And that changed life for many of these people. Of course, it's not as straightforward as it sounds. These are very highly entrenched into the system, these agents. And again, there are cartelizations. I've literally been in rooms with exporter associations where they've threatened me that, hey, do not try to surpass us.
I wouldn't be surprised. Yeah.
So it's not
watch
that,
your back.
Yeah. Totally. It's not that straightforward, but there have been instances where we've actually been able to connect these manufacturers now directly with fabric manufacturers. And prices and cost of goods has gone down by 60%, up to 60%. So that has been one of the highlights and something that we're very, very proud of. And the second bit on the B2C side of things was when we entered Indonesia about 3 years ago now, two and a half, three years ago now, it was extremely hard. It was extremely challenging to get items delivered to all parts of Indonesia. Of course, everyone was doing Jakarta, Jabodetabek, the Jakarta megacity region. Some people were doing Bali, some people were also doing Sumatra. But either the timelines were like 15 days or no one was offering cash on delivery, which is like 90% of the payment method used in these countries. And that is when, with the sort of an amalgamation of our ops and tech systems, we built this app optimization/route optimization tool, partnered with about 5 different providers of last mile logistics, and sort of built this mechanism where the orders were now to be shipped via which particular route through which particular provider, depending on capability, capacity, and reach. The SLAs dropped by nearly 50%, and we were doing across Indonesia deliveries with COD enabled within 6 months of launch. That was another great thing that happened, I think, and sort of pushed us to becoming a very loved and accepted brand in the country.
Mm-hmm. No, I mean, for sure, when you're saving people money, it typically works, but like in many industries where there's middlemen, of course the middlemen will not be very highly appreciated. So you know, maybe you can convert them. I don't know.
Yeah.
It's just like, again,
yeah,
old habits die hard, right?
Yeah.
So, moving a little bit to a different skew of a question, because we have a listener that was asking about sustainable development, and I think this is a big topic, sustainability in general, and you know, you hear a lot about global warming and a lot of all of these things. So have you, is this also on your agenda? Do you do things specifically, you know, for the sustainability agenda, or how does it work?
For sure. I think And going a little back, actually, in time, when I was studying in university, there was always two type of people in the class, right? There was one group of people who wanted to go into corporates and earn money. They were tagged as people who want to earn money, and then there was another section of people who wanted to go and help people, so help people and earn money. I think what Zilingo has enabled us all to do is not just be in that sort of I wouldn't call it corporate, but not just be in an environment where you are trying to build a business, but also help people, and also help the planet. And how does this happen, right? It's very entrenched, that as and when you start optimizing a particular supply chain, you eventually start helping things on a more macro scale. Now, unlike an electronic supply chain where a Foxconn exists and is pretty much building iPhones for everyone in the world, the fashion supply chain is so fragmented with hundreds and thousands of manufacturers across the world that if you were to in any way sort of aggregate these businesses and bring some sort of efficiency, you will save not just time or money, but also the planet in some ways. Now, to be a little more tangible, right? So, building a T-shirt, for example, or manufacturing a T-shirt takes about, I don't know the exact, I'm forgetting the exact number, but about 20,000 liters of water, I'm assuming, from growing cotton to then manufacturing it to then shipping it, etc. So the whole process is about 20,000 liters of water. Now, the thing is with Zilingo's trend analytics tool, if you are able to actually predict better what sort of T-shirt you should be building, the inventory won't go waste. Like, someone is definitely gonna go and buy it. I'm not saying with 100% surety that the item would get sold, but the probability of getting sold increases. And if you're actually able to do that, you are saving water, you're saving the planet. We also work across, there are efforts across the company where we are trying to reduce waste. So again, one of the things that we're doing with our fabric manufacturers is that one of the bigger challenges for these guys is, now let's assume I get an order from Zara and I have to procure 10 tons of fabric. They would generally order 12 tons, accounting for wastage, and generally there would be a wastage of about a ton, and another ton would be left. Now, what do you do with that, right? So we've actually designed a program where we are procuring this excess fabric, putting it on the platform, and then selling it. So that has, again, not just helped these guys get better money, but also reduce wastage on the whole. And of course, all of this ties back to saving water, CO2 emissions, etc., etc. So very committed. I don't think these are different things, and I'm not a big fan of people doing business and then allocating 0.5% of their top line on CSR. I think both need to be interlinked, and I think we are going in that right direction.
We had another question in terms of focus. So for now, you seem to be quite focused on ASEAN, on Southeast Asia. Are there plans? And I think you touched briefly on it, but are there plans also on Middle East? There was one listener that was specifically asking about Middle East because he's from there.
Yeah, no, definitely. So in fact, when we started, it was a big Asia to Asia story, ASEAN to ASEAN story. But I think as we've matured and grown over time, we've also realized the fact that it's super hard to beat Asian supply, both in terms of quality and pricing. You need to have a global vision in terms of the demand. So we are very open to exploring demand in other parts of the world as well. In fact, as I mentioned, and I gave the example of a US business, that is actually a real example. So we actually have set up an office now in the US and in Sydney in Australia as well, where I think, I don't know why this realization didn't happen earlier, but we are actually able to sell faster, better, with higher margins in developed world, because I think the proximity is lesser to the supply and hence it's easier. So totally, definitely. Middle East is one of the countries or one of the regions on the radar as well.
Super. We talked also a little bit about disruption, about the new things that you're doing, about the new things that you're planning to do. There's existing, obviously, there's some existing providers in the space of supply chain and e-commerce and all of that. But where or which one of the initiatives that you're doing do you think will make the most impact in terms of disrupting, if you may, right? And you've talked about the one-stop solution. I mean, I think in my head that probably is it, but I'm just going to ask the question because it was specifically framed like that.
Yeah, right? I think we need to go deeper into factories, into manufacturing, and I think that is what is going to cause the next wave of disruption in the supply chain of fashion. I gave one example of ERPs and better line management, etc. And again, since the whole system is so unregulated, even a small piece of thing happening there helps. So, for example, till today, efficiencies and the lines, etc., are being managed on whiteboards, even for the factories that are producing for the biggest international brands. Happy to share some content around how we are changing those things as well. But I think one of the things that our factory owners keep talking to us about is pilferage. And they say that there is a lot of stuff that is actually getting stolen from the factories. So, and this is something that we are having an active discussion with some of our investors who are very keen on looking on things like this in terms of technology, creating disruption, and with a 3 to 5 years view, right? So we are actually thinking of installing not just a software, but hardware and IoTs in these factories where you have... no one needs to manually then upload that, hey, these are the products in my warehouse. Now, if there is an IoT there and the inventory is auto-updated onto the systems, there the chances of pilferage and theft reduces drastically. And again, this is not a small problem. It's a 5 to 10% of the items getting lost. Another problem or a big challenge that one of our Bangladeshi partners told us was that, hey, I have about 40,000 people working in my factory. I think 5,000 of them don't exist. So they are ghost workers who are just somehow getting the attendance done and they never come to work. So now, again, you can't think of the solution as putting a fingerprint reader, because 40,000 people doing fingerprint reader a full day is going to go in there. So we are actually thinking of installing some sort of RFID chips in these factories so that as you walk in and through your ID card, etc., it gets read and you are in and your attendance is done. So I think there will be some sort of disruption in terms of the entire process in which these factories are run. Some sort of blockchain contracts are something that are on the radar as well, because again, trust is broken. Supply chain is so fragmented. So if you have a close-knit blockchain sort of solution around contracts, that can also definitely help. So we're looking at into blockchain, into IoT, into some sort of hardware as well as years go on. And that is, I feel, going to be the next change of the supply chain, I guess, in the fashion space.
Mm. Well, I mean, if I can chip in with my own observation upon going to a lot of conferences, and I've just returned from Europe and I've attended an Industry 4.0. This was not for fashion specifically, but was for manufacturing in general. And top, you know, Fortune 500 companies are all about all this, you know, Industry 4.0, IoT, blockchain, machine learning, artificial intelligence. But again, I think, you know, where you guys operate and where most of the other 99% of the companies that exist are not Fortune 500.
Yeah.
You know, they're not at that level of development, technology, yes, and so on, right? And then you need to kind of, you know, they, like you rightfully said, they run maybe manufacturing lines on a board, or they run,
exactly,
their company on an Excel spreadsheet. And
yes,
it's just a reality of today's,
exactly,
world, right? So
exactly,
then how do we help all these companies also up,
yes,
their game, right? So
yes,
it's interesting what you mentioned, because it almost sounds in my mind that as in you will have a plethora of, or that you're aiming, you're trying to get to a plethora of different tools, or it's almost like you're building a toolbox, and depending on where,
yeah,
the company is,
yeah,
or the manufacturing or the
yeah,
producer is, okay, let's see what you,
yeah,
need to make biggest impact, right,
totally,
on your business.
And I think data is gold, right? End of the day, tying back to one of the questions you asked earlier, that are we really monetizing on these tools today? Maybe 100% not, maybe some percentage. But the idea is that if you don't get a large chunk of these businesses on the platform upfront and really realize what the problem is and then double down on that, you're going to be living in a dream world where you'll be solving one small problem, which probably doesn't even matter to the larger masses.
Mm. And let's talk a little bit about, you know, about people, because ultimately,
yes,
this is what makes,
yes,
all this beautiful technologies work and come together. So, you know, you have about 300 people right now in your team. So what makes it, you know, what's the most difficult, I'd say? Because it's also, when you're building such solutions that can be quite broad and you're kind of building a product that doesn't exist or hasn't existed, it's much more difficult to find the right type of mindset. Yeah. And it's easier for Citibank, let's say, to find another banker than it is for you guys to find 100%. Somebody that hasn't done what you've done. 100%. Because you don't, you know, so how do you to tackle that?
I think very important question, extremely, extremely hard to hire the right people. I think that is probably one of the biggest challenges. When you're building something like this, which has not existed before, or something that is revolutionary in sorts, it is not really specific experience that matters. Of course, it is important, or it would be, it's a good have that someone has come from, let's say, a supply chain background, or someone's done some sort of marketing services in another company before. That's all helpful. But I think what is the most important part is the right attitude and sort of alignment to the vision. Now, there have been a lot of people who've come and spoken to us who are great CVs and have great experience. But when you talk to them about the vision that, hey, the idea is to transform the fashion supply chain, which is about 3% of the global GDP, that's about $3-4 trillion, people are just not able to fathom it. And the idea is, and a lot of people tell us that, hey, in 4 years, you guys have raised a lot of money, it's a good valuation. We feel like we're not even 1% done, because all of this has happened at pace because no one has really touched that space. Like, it's virgin. Once you start touching that space, the opportunity is just immense. We are looking for people who have that audacity, have that courage, have that alignment to the vision that, hey, we are here to change the world in some way or the other, but change it for good. And I think that is the most critical factor here. We've had people hired straight out of university. We also have people with 20 plus years of experience. But you know what? When you talk to them, you realize that they talk the same language and they understand that vision. But it's been extremely challenging. It's been extremely challenging. We have about people from about 15 different nationalities. So we scout for people from across the world who understand the vision and who want to really make a change.
How about the future? How about, back to the people that end, and, you know, it's a common question, whether you are graduating or, to be truthful, also if you're 50, I mean, if just picking an age, right? I mean, let's say it's more senior in your career. Because it's getting to a point where things are shifting so quickly that maybe you are very experienced in something that might not be relevant anymore. What do you see in the next 5-10 years, right, in terms of skill sets? What should people focus on? Or what should you be learning? Or what type of... It can be soft skills, it can be hard, but maybe both, yeah.
I think, especially for a company like ourselves, which is growing so fast, in terms of... soft skills, let's say, first, and I talk a lot to our younger team about this, leadership and management, because what has happened in the past as well is for us definitely, and I'm assuming for companies who have been revolutionary in the past, like the Googles and Apples of the world, who grew fast and where leadership positions come faster, is I believe that it won't be a conventional company trajectory where you will probably become a manager after 5 years and you probably have a team of 10 after 10 years. It will all come faster. So I think the leadership ability, the team management, etc., would become extremely critical. What that also means is, and that is, I think, the slight an issue, if I may put it that way, is that people need to be mature faster. But then you have the Instagrams and Facebooks of the world making it an instant gratification world, and maturity levels do go down because of these things at times, and we see it. I think people need to be mature faster, people need to absorb better, people need to be leading better, and I think that all needs to happen faster. So I think in terms of the soft skills, those are some of the things that we personally look at. We look at people who are mature enough in what they're doing, irrespective of the age, etc. In terms of hard skills, I feel, again, it would be important, and I try and teach myself this, to not be an expert, but at least know about things. Like when we started the business, I didn't know much about fashion, I didn't know much about supply chain, but we've been on the ground for 4 years now, really learning what are the problems, or how really does an IoT work, or what really is a custom supply chain looking like. One thing I regret is I don't code, but I would love to. I think it's extremely important that you know what other people in the company you're collaborating with are doing. Not probably to the extent that a CTO will know, but at least the basics. So I think it will be important that you have a plethora of skills in terms of at least understanding what people are doing and be a mature leader.
Let's take it personal and let's take it to you. Let's come to yourself, because you have you know, in 4 years you have grown tremendously with the company, and you probably are a very good example of what you just said, you know, learning fast and maturing fast.
Yes.
What has proven to be some of the most successful things that have taken you there, and also some of the challenges that you've gone through? Because I'm sure there's been both, right?
I think persistence is something and it came to me immediately as you asked. I think it's not been an easy ride. Personally, also, I've failed multiple times. I've been to meetings where people have thrown me out. That, hey, you are a small company, who are you, I don't care, and what are you talking about, and get out. And and there have been instances also where we've spoken to some of the biggest industry leaders and they've been extremely humble. So I think persistence is first. You can't sit and have a broken heart and be sad about things. I think you need to keep moving on, because to be frank, the best part about our world today, about the 21st century today, is that there are many opportunities. So there is no time to be disheartened, and you need to keep moving on, because opportunity is not going to dry down. And I think the second thing has been humility. And Ankiti, we all talk a lot about this internally, that we need to be a humble team, because we've seen the biggest of the people, biggest of the investors, biggest of the business leaders being extremely humble. And we've also seen a lot of aggressive people go down the bad way. So I think that is something that is ingrained in the philosophy of the company as well, and that I take very seriously personally, that whoever you might become, you need to stay humble, because you are here to serve a mission. And the company and the mission matters more than who you are personally. And I think it's very important to know that.
Yes, yes. How about as a leader, right? And maybe as a principal, or maybe you may have a principal, or you may have, I don't know, an advisor. What would be something that you would, apart from what you just shared, that you would do as a leader consistently?
I think I would fail faster. Very cliche, but giving a bit better example or more tangible example of what that means really is that we have a lot of people coming into the organization who are top performers, and they always want to deliver something to you which is 110% perfect. And it doesn't work, because things are moving really, really fast and time is of essence. So you can't just be looking at quality of work. It has to be a quality of work plus time as another axis into this entire situation. And you need to realize that, because if you can deliver to me something 100% great after 10 days versus 80% in 2 days, I would prefer the first option. I think that is the biggest advice that I would love to give people, that please don't forget about the time aspect of things, because things are moving really fast. So perfection plus time need to work hand in hand.
Yes, yes. Super. Well, Adi, thank you very much for the sharing. Really, really insightful conversation and discussion, and very, very good examples and practical case studies. So I'm sure that the audience took a lot. So appreciate you having us, joining us today. And good luck in building the company even further.
Brilliant. Thank you so much. Thanks, Radu. Appreciate it.
Thank you for listening to our podcast. If you liked what you heard, be sure to follow us on radupalamariu.com/podcast for all the show notes, links, and extra tips covered in the interview. Make sure also to subscribe to our emailing list to get the news in the nick of time. If you're listening through a streaming platform like iTunes or Stitcher and you like what we do, please kindly review and give us 5 stars so we can keep the energy flowing and get more people to find out about our podcast. I'm most active on LinkedIn, so do feel free to follow me to stay tuned for our latest articles as well as future guests for the podcast. And if you have any suggestions or any other idea, please feel free to write to me. I respond to all. And also, please make sure not to miss our next episode, where we will be having a few other C-level and top leaders in supply chain joining us. Stay tuned.